from the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you, as always, joining us on the show this month. And if ever you have a question you'd like to get on this program, you can email that to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we're taping this just a few days before Thanksgiving. How much of the cooking are you responsible for on Thanksgiving?
Zero. There have been a couple Thanksgivings where I fried a turkey, but that...
Is that the reason you're responsible for zero cooking this Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm not who you want doing your Thanksgiving dinner. It's always been known in our family, if you can eat it for breakfast or do it on a grill, I'm your guy. Other than those categories, Sherry is a terrific cook, and all the girls have taken an interest. So there's more than enough cooking talent without me involved.
All right. So you're just responsible for the eating part of it then.
I hold up my end there very well.
let's move on to other things. As many people expected would happen in the interim between our last show and now, the university has removed the interim label from Provost Jay Ackridge. When you named him interim some time ago, did you kind of expect that that would be the case eventually?
I fully expected it. I thought he would be, as he was for interim, the obvious candidate, so thoroughly prepared. So widely respected and liked on campus, I didn't know where we'd come up with a better candidate. And although there was a very diligent search with some of our finest faculty involved, and was not surprised that they did not find anyone any better.
The last couple of people who have held this job, Tim Sands, Deva Dutta, have gone on to bigger and better things. I don't know better, but bigger things, higherfalutin titles elsewhere. What do you do to keep the Purdue West Lafayette provost job from being seen as a stepping stone to writing your own ticket somewhere else in academia?
It's becoming a common line. Cradle of quarterbacks, cradle of astronauts, cradle of university presidents, with the provost job being the jumping off point. It's the constant dilemma of pursuing excellence in any endeavor, maybe the principal assignment is to assemble the very best talent you can. And when you do that, it follows naturally that others will notice and attempt to steal them away. And that could happen again one day. But for now, I'm just happy that we have yet another fantastic provost and someone who I am already having a great deal of fun learning from and working with.
The question was asked of him, and let me pose it to you. Do you view him as a possible successor? Your contract at the moment is set to run out at the end of June, beginning of July in 2020, not all that long from now. And someone could perhaps say maybe Purdue needs to elevate a provost to a non-interim presidential title like what Tim Sands had before you were hired. Do you view the provost as somebody who might take over for you? You said you were all fully prepared to make him from interim to regular provost. Do you think he could step into your shoes whenever you decide to step away?
I like giving straight answers, Stan, so I will say yes. Now, I'll go on to say that I think anyone we would put in that job ought to be capable of stepping in, at least on an emergency basis, if necessary, and I would be uncomfortable if we put anyone in that job that the trustees or I felt could not handle my responsibilities if called on. But as you illustrated, the last several Purdue provosts have all been fully qualified and have gone on. And I think that's the standard we ought to keep applying. I'll also say that I've always found it good practice in business or government or now here to try to have not one but more than one, preferably three or more candidates for any top job, pre-identified, at least as candidates. And
I have to ask, does that mean there's an official short list somewhere for who Purdue's next president will be?
Not necessarily official, and it wouldn't be an exclusive list. I'm just saying that you ought to have an idea. I think that because things happen, people are hired away or become ill or something, and I think whoever is in leadership capacity is in default if there isn't some sort of at least backup plan. So, yes to Jay, but yes to any provost, and that would not necessarily exhaust the list of people that we already have here who might one day step in.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels. Send your questions via email to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet those too at WBAA News on Twitter. Coming up the day after we've taped this show, you are going to Indianapolis to make an announcement about another affordability initiative. Can you tell us a little about what you're going to say and will have said by the time people have heard this?
I'm really proud of our financial aid people who have been working now for years to make Purdue accessible and affordable, and they've come up with another way to do that. Basically, we will be saying to every qualified Indiana applicant with family income up to $70,000 per year.
That's family income across
family
the household.
Family income up to $70,000 per year. So this picks up everyone in the Pell Grant category and far beyond. And Purdue will be saying to them, if you're qualified, that we will cover any gap between your contribution and any other grants you may have and the tuition, fees, and books. And so this, we hope, will be tip a number of Hoosier students into coming here who might have been weighing it against other choices. Basically, this would just leave them with living costs, room or board, however they deal with that. It's another step forward, we believe, in keeping Purdue open to everybody who can meet our standards.
How, in a situation like that, do you determine what a family's contribution is, what they spend out of pocket?
This is the famous FAFSA, the form that families fill out, which I hope the federal government will simplify here somewhere soon. But basically, that's what it does. It's a well-established formula that looks at a family's financial situation, how many students or how many children they may have in college and so forth, and says that an expected contribution is X thousand dollars. And then so what we will now – we're giving a guarantee in essence that after you look at that number and any other grants, maybe a Pell Grant or some other scholarship the student has won, we'll top that up to the full extent of tuition, fees, and books. So not a complete answer. It'll still leave some challenges out there, but it's another step forward.
Who are you aiming this at? Are you aiming it at the families, or are you aiming it at your competition, who you're trying to lure the students away from?
Aiming it at the families and the students. I think Purdue is just – We're drowning in applications again this year, Stan. As of this morning, 23% up over a number last year I was told probably represented a ceiling, that we got to 48,000, and our admissions people thought, well, that's probably about as high as it can go, but it looks like it's going to go higher. I think, you know, Purdue is very, very attractive to today's aspiring serious students. What we want to do is make sure none of them is deterred by the cost if we can help it.
On to other things. We talked a little bit about last month about the ongoing conversation that you've begun to have and now have apparently continued to have, perhaps at least through social media, with Illinois Senator Dick Durbin about the Kaplan deal. And last month on the program, you said you thought that the senator didn't have the whole story and that perhaps an aide had brought this to him and that he didn't fully understand it, which you said you sort of had seen happen when you worked for Senator Lugar some time ago. In the intervening month, just to catch people up, the senator has issued a number of tweets saying that you personally were misleading people about the deal. I was a little surprised he included your Twitter handle specifically in one of those tweets. What was your reaction to that kind of being directed at you rather than at the institution?
I didn't pay much attention. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, I didn't start the conversation, and I've only ever answered one question about it. I think that I choose to believe that he wants the same thing we do, a quality education for more students and many adults who otherwise won't ever achieve a college degree. There's no denying it. There were factual errors in what he said. He said their default rate was 50%. It's 4. That's a pretty big miss. So, but look, I think he I assume his heart's in the right place. He wants the same things that we do. We're not arguing with him, and I just hope that he'll take an open stance and see if we can't do better than he thinks the. Some of the online sector has been doing in the past.
Another thing the senator tweeted, and I'm quoting now, was, quote, "I'm not the only one with concerns," end quote. And he notes then that some 300 Purdue faculty, and I looked this morning, it's up to 321 now, signed a petition online against the deal. What was your reaction to that petition?
We pay attention when even a handful of our faculty have a point of view that needs to be heard. So, of course, we've had extensive conversations that I know will continue. You know, 50-some of those signatures were not faculty. 5 people signed it twice. When you finally put it under the scope, you're about 10% of our multi-campus faculty. And that's not trivial. But it is. This conversation has been on for close to 8 months now. And if so we note when 10% hold a viewpoint, but we know that there are many, many alternative viewpoints, and a lot of our faculty are very interested in how they can grow their own teaching in the online space when New U becomes a reality.
I guess it should be noted that those voices haven't been nearly as public as the detractors have been.
Nothing unusual about that, regardless what the controversy is. Those who have a negative point of view or tend to be passionate and be more heard, and they're more newsworthy. So we've seen this is just a fact of life here and everywhere.
It's
just,
and obviously this decision is about to be made by the Higher Learning Commission next and not in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you've got this petition on one side, I mean, I asked you last month, I guess I'll ask again, can you
it will be completely drowned out to the extent the commission looks at it. They are already have heard from higher education organizations, higher education leaders, former secretaries of education, a host of very, very reputable authorities who believe that this is a very big step forward for the education of adults in America. So if it came to, and I don't believe, my understanding is the Higher Learning Commission basically stays within their own criteria, but if they go to the public record, what they're going to find is an overwhelming preponderance of support.
So those people, learned though they may be, don't work and live at Purdue on a daily basis, and so they're affected a little bit differently, wouldn't you agree, that than the people who wrote the petition?
I don't understand the question.
Just in terms of how you weigh one side versus the other.
Well, if they look at the mail they have received, they'll see, I guess, 10% of the Purdue faculty community, which I think they ought to take note of. They will also see a wealth of very positive support from experts and leaders and organizations like our own land-grant association, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, strongly urging them to support innovation and support an expansion of opportunity, which the New U possibility represents. So it's for them to decide, but I have every reason to believe that just like the Indiana Higher Education Commission and just like the U.S. Department of Education, they will see this as a positive thing and a step forward.
Higher Learning Commission sent some folks to campus late last month to do a site visit, met with faculty, staff, students, things like that. Were you involved at all in that visit?
Yeah. I was the host of the first of many meetings, and I thought it was really very, very constructive. They had good questions, and we had answers to all of them.
Any sort of ballparking you can do on where they were, things they were particularly focusing on when they were here?
It was pretty comprehensive, and they're very professional, and I was only party to the first hour, hour and a half of what was a full day, but by all accounts, it was very positive. You know, there was a meeting open to any faculty, and there were more voices in support, I'm told, than against, so they may have noticed that.
On to some other things. You've announced plans to build some new science lab space that'll help ease the burden on a couple of aging buildings on the campus. When do you think that new space is going to be fully functional?
Wish it was tomorrow. We need it now. Probably waited too long. But we do believe by 19. That's the goal. And we're going to move as fast as we can. I think, you know, because we've talked about it, Stan, that we have to be careful, I think, around here about big investments in capital stock. But this, I think, passes every test. We've become, as you know, even more science and technology-based than Purdue has been historically. Something like 60% of our entering classes now are planning to pursue a STEM major. And essentially every student here will be studying science in one way or another. And so we have let the very old, they've served well, but for decades now, facilities, particularly in Brown Hall and also in Lilly Hall, go too long. And so we're going to move as fast as we can to create what I hope will be a great new facility where the vast, vast majority of Purdue students will pass through it at one time or another. So it'll be there for chemistry and biology, essentially. But those every engineer studies those subjects, and our liberal arts graduates all have a science requirement. We think it's a central part of every kind of modern education, and so we need to do this and do it as fast and well as we can.
What do you do with those two other buildings that we had seen? Even in a trustees meeting I remember going to, there was pictures that were shown up in a slideshow of ceiling tiles in Lilly Hall falling down. What do you do with those two buildings?
Well, we've been putting money into their rehab, and particularly in Lilly. I will say that, as we always do, before we decided to move to to new construction, we looked at the repair possibilities. Brown Hall, really, it would just be not smart to pour money into trying to bring it to modern standards, and so its future's in doubt.
I have a couple of friends who were chemistry professors, and they said, you know, that they had been on steering committees to try to figure this out, and figured out that with all of the pipes and all of the venting that's necessary, it was just going to be prohibitively expensive to do that. And so when you're talking about building a building that hopefully will serve you for the next 50 years, 60 years, something like that, how do you think about doing that so that you hopefully alleviate these concerns for as long as you possibly can in the next iteration of that building?
This is a really good question. And what we've asked the group to think about is not what the labs of today look like, but what might they look like as teaching evolves and as science evolves. And can we build flexibly enough, since nobody can see the future completely, that that the buildings can adapt to changes? And I'll give you an example. The Wilmoth Active Learning Center, our new library, was very much built for flexibility and the possibility that, you know, walls can be moved, chairs aren't bolted down, and if the nature of teaching keeps on changing, that the building, we won't be trapped in facilities that are no longer suitable for that. And so we want to do whatever that means. And that, but that's the question I've put to them: where do we think the labs of 10 and 15 years are headed? And since we can't see beyond that, how can we leave our successors enough flexibility that they can get the maximum duration out of whatever we build?
Is this a general philosophy now, build more malleable buildings?
You bet. You know, the open office space, for example, has been highly, highly successful in some of the new engineering buildings Grissom, that, for instance, that we've built. This is the way of the world in general these days, but we need to, in higher ed, we need to notice it too. And I would say there's two big themes that are pretty much general. One, you want to build for collaboration. No more people going in, closing an office door and being locked away, all by themselves. We want people colliding and exchanging and getting to know each other and cooperating and maybe challenging each other's views. And so that's one thing that I think the buildings of today and tomorrow need to reflect. And then the second is what your question takes us to. How do you leave room for the further changes that we may not be able to predict today, but we know are coming?
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels. Send questions for the show to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to ask you a couple of quick things. I saw a story in a Detroit newspaper, actually, saying that you had received a letter from an alumni donor asking about what happened when Michigan quarterback Wilton Spate was hurt during the homecoming football game here a couple of months ago. And, of course, there were a number of stories that came out of that questioning the sort of medical care that he received in the athletic department, and others have talked about that. Did it come to you differently? Did you respond to it differently when it just came from somebody who wasn't part of the Michigan football team, but somebody who was an alumnus who said, "Hey, I'd like to ask you about this"? Did you think about it differently?
No, I was very concerned in each instance when we simply heard from the family, or at least through the media, that they weren't satisfied, and then when some of our alums noticed, both required, I thought, a prompt look. We took a very prompt look. I'm not saying nothing better could have happened. The one thing we identified is there wasn't a police escort to get them to the unit they chose to go to, the Michigan medical staff chose to go to, and that might have cost a few minutes. But most of the rest turned out not to be justified, and we have some apologies, frankly, from the Michigan University of Michigan medical people who were not nearly so unhappy as those accounts suggested. So the Michigan folks were in charge, and they made the calls at each step along the way, and I think our people did a good job. But, you know, it's not a bad thing when an athlete gets hurt like that. But it's not a bad thing when you have a little criticism so you can go back and check everything you're doing. And if and when we ever have to help another player in that situation, maybe we'll be a little better at it. But to a large extent, that story in the Detroit paper had errors and was a bum rap.
On to other things. You gave a speech recently to the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce where you said the following about the city. You said, quote, "I think the cities, the towns that are successful, they have a strategy, they have a plan, and they have business, political, academic leaders in the community leading the charge. There doesn't seem to be that vision, that plan, that forward-looking vision, if you will, in Terre Haute." It seems kind of harsh.
Well, I didn't think, not to the people who were there. I got a lot of very positive comments. You know, in my last job, when I made it my business to travel the state relentlessly, I was in Terre Haute 50-plus times, so I know the town a little bit. The statement you just read is, I think, accurate, but it was preceded by a long inventory of assets, positive assets, that I think Terre Haute has, including, by the way, three or more fine universities. And so I was really reflecting back, Stan, comments I have heard from people in Terre Haute for a long time, which is that we fight against each other too much. We don't pull together. We have too many little squabbles, and it's getting in the way. And I'd heard that over the course of time. I'd called a few people before I went to give the speech and sort of ask them. That came up more and more. So, you know, the reaction I got that night and since been very positive, that people saw it as a supportive speech. Indiana wants that area to do as well as it can. And also maybe just a little bit of a Dutch uncle approach that says, come on, folks, let's love to see you get together on some big things that are good for everybody. Set aside maybe some of the smaller disputes that have been a little too common over there.
And we should say that Terre Haute and Vigo County famously have been a presidential election bellwether for a long time. It's fairly close to a 50-50 split in terms of political ideology there in Vigo County. So let me ask you, is there a difference between giving a speech like that in your last job and giving it in your current job? You mentioned the universities, and of course, they have in Rose Holman a very highly regarded undergraduate engineering-focused university. I'm sure you compete with Rose Holman for the top engineering undergraduate students in the state every year. Does it run the risk of coming off as a little, I don't know, self-serving that the president of Purdue is saying to the people in Terre Haute, well, maybe there's a little bit of discord here, and the public view is, well, Mitch Daniels is looking down a little bit on Terre Haute?
I don't think one person in that crowd got that impression.
Okay.
It was quite the opposite. I was over there to boost their spirits, remind them of the positives. I'm one of the biggest Rose Holman fans around. Tell everybody how lucky Indiana is to have them. And Indiana State's come a long way, too, by the way. And all that I said that night, all I did was try to give some, as I think you should, some constructive advice that, boy, you know, you got potential you're not realizing now. And I think everybody in that room knew what I was talking about when I said that sometimes they've spent too much energy on local squabbles when they could have held hands and moved forward on something. If you think that was a stern talk, you should have heard some I gave in Lake County, Indiana, in my last job, where I said, you know, that you folks, between fractured government, over-expensive government, sometimes corrupt government, you're preventing yourself from being all you could be and all Indiana wants you to be. So, I mean, I don't think it has to do with the job. If you're invited to go somewhere, I think you should, as Alex Haley used to teach, find the good and praise it, but also bring something constructive, some positive suggestion about how that community or that business, whoever you're talking to, could be better yet.
One last question in our last couple of minutes. Speaking of places with fractured government, I noticed that Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, who has said in the past he wants to sort of follow your example, be a little more like you, seems to have taken your politician on a motorcycle trick from your last job. He's doing it in campaign ads now, and it seems to me you've got two choices. You can either send this guy a Valentine's Day card, or you can tell him to stop stealing your act.
Well, it's not my act. You know, that has happened to be my hobby for 45 years or something. I don't know when he took it up. He's not the first person that out there who in a similar job who decided to ride things. So there's no copyright on it. In my case, it was something I've always enjoyed and still do. Got one here at Purdue, got one down in Indy, and I think it's a great way, you know, to meet different people. And also a fun way to get away from work a little bit. But if he's discovered it, I'm assuming it's authentic. More power to him.
Real quick, in just a few seconds, are you at all watching the parallels that could be drawn between Illinois, which you criticized a fair amount in your last job, and Governor Rauner, and trying to have your name attached to it?
No, you don't take, shouldn't take pleasure in the difficulties of others, but the more Illinois mismanages its situation, and it's not Rauner's fault, the better it is for Indiana. And, you know, maybe that's where finally they wise up, is watching enough of that damage occur.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks as always. Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
We'll do it again next month. This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for the Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Purdue University Press, publishing global scholarship and popular regional work since 1960, and featuring the fifth edition of Creating Moments of Joy Along the Alzheimer's Journey, now available. More at thepress.purdue.edu.